I am Mark Lasanti.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach podcast, or Lasanti and Leach podcast this week, episode 59 here at the New Republic. That polypless person you're listening to on the other end of this conversation is Mark Lasanti of MTV, formerly of Grantland, and my former colleague at the long-lived, much-heralded Yahoo, the Projector. Mark, thank you for filling in for Tim this week.
Oh, you're very welcome, and hi to Tim wherever he is, resting his ravaged throat.
I was kind of disappointed because, you know, Tim and I have been friends for a long time, and I was very worried about him. It's a surgery. He says it's minor, but, you know, no surgery is truly minor when you have reached the advanced age that we have all reached now. And so I was worried about him.
But Medicare is going to pick it up for him, right?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Totally. It's fine. He's been saving up and for years and years and years. So he's been ready for this and any other possible calamities. But so I was very nervous about him. And I sent him a note. I'm like, good luck today, man. It's going to be fine. You're going to be great. And he's like, yeah, it's going to be good. I'm going to be all right. And then like 10 minutes after he went into surgery, he was putting stuff up on Facebook. Like, of things that he'd written. And I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, yeah, it was totally easy. It's fine. So Grierson, shed no tears for Grierson. He is perfectly fine. But we have Mark this week to fill in. I'm delighted to talk to you. Mark, I have to say, someone wrote a great piece the other day on Up Rocks about how much they missed Mad Men.
And yeah.
And particularly because it's really – one of the great things to miss about Mad Men was that Mad Men was deeply fun to write about. And so I feel obliged once again, every time I talk to you on this stuff, I sometimes go back and read the Mad Men power rankings pure enjoyment. I do. I swear to God, I do that. So it is a delight to have you on.
Well, thank you. It's a delight to be here and to not so subtly undermine Tim Grierson's place on the podcast.
Oh, it's not difficult. I mean, honestly, like, it's fine. It's fine. It'll be nice to get somebody in here that I actually like.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. It'll be a nice break for you.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So this is episode 59. So we are going to talk this week. As I mentioned on last week's podcast, Grierson and I, we did a bunch of reboots already. So we're going to have a reboot later. But first, before that, we're going to talk about Kong, Skull Island, and Personal Shopper. But first off, we remind you, as always, to please subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on SoundCloud, newrepublic.com. Please rate and review us on iTunes if you do, and give us the name of the movie that you would like us to review. We will discuss it in our reboot section. We have one reboot movie this week. The review comes to us from Gabby JRT. Terrific podcast, 5 stars. Says Gabby JRT. It's always a pleasure to listen to this podcast every week. Grierson and Leach discuss movies with the incisive eye one would suspect. I'm often discussing things with my eye, yet never hold back their deep love of film. As perhaps the one member of Gen X who feels basically no 80s nostalgia, I appreciate their judgment on poorly aging comedies from that era, so I would like to review one of the comedies from that decade that might hold up, A Fish Called Wanda. So in a reboot section, the voice from the past, pre-Polyp Grierson, will be discussing A Fish Called Wanda. And of course, and if you haven't listened, Lasanti, I don't know if you know this or not, listen to this episode. Grierson and I famously hate 80s comedies. we are still showering from Fletch. Fletch is horrible. I'm sorry, Fletch is horrible. Fletch is terrible. Chevy Chase is the worst.
I don't share those opinions.
I know.
It's maybe not my place to say so right now, but you couldn't be more incorrect in your opinions about Fletch.
I'm sorry. Okay, well, thanks for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you. All right, but our first movie this week we will be discussing is Kong Skull Island.
That's Kong. He's God on the island.
We don't belong here.
But the devils live below us. I call them skull crawlers.
Why?
Because it sounds neat.
Okay.
Look, I just made that name up. I'm trying to scare you.
I'm fine calling them that. Are you cool with it?
Yeah, that seems like a good
name. I like the name.
All right, Kong Skull Island is directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts and written by Dan Gilroy and like 45 other people. It stars Tom Hiddleston as Hero Man and Samuel L. Jackson as Samuel L. Jackson and John Goodman as, hey, he's really looking pretty good these days, and Brie Larson as, I'm sorry, this was your first project after winning an Oscar. It is Kong Skull Island. It is another retelling of the King Kong story. This time it takes place in the Vietnam era, which is to say is the end of the war. A troop led by Samuel L. Jackson, a platoon led by Samuel L. Jackson. John Goodman, is basically this, he runs this shady government segment of the government where they want to go find out this mysterious Skull Island. What's there? What can they have it? So the platoon led by Samuel L. Jackson, along with Tom Hiddleston, who is a map guy who seems to understand the terrain of places where no one else can understand the terrain, and Brie Larson, a quote, anti-war photographer, they all come to this island, and wouldn't you know it, King Kong is there. More worrisomely, there are many, many terrifying insects and beings there that eventually King Kong must protect them from. Also there, quite amusingly, is John C. Reilly. I like to pretend that he has actually been on the island since World War II. I liked everything about him except for the fact that he was a Cubs fan. And generally speaking, we have ourselves another King Kong story. Now, I have a few things to get into this first up, but I will say my kind of where I come from on this, I am a huge, huge fan, unabashedly so, of Peter Jackson's King Kong. I think that is it's insane. It's almost underrated in how insane that movie is. The scene where they go into the insect pit and everything is going nuts and Jack Black and Adrian Brody is covered in cockroaches, and it's just kind of insane thing that only Peter Jackson could pull off. And one of the things I really love about that movie is it's like this big King Kong movie, but it's filtered through his kind of weird obsessive nuttiness. This movie is not that. This movie is very conventional. It is very Jurassic World, hit all your marks. Colin Trevorrow, hit all your marks and don't mess up anything. I feel like it's very safe. There's a few things I liked about the movie, but I'll say that I found Kong himself, though quite anatomically rendered, to the point that I kept trying to figure out, like, this is the most impressive visual Kong I've seen, to the point where I could not figure out where he was, like, tucking the Kong penis, because this is clearly like, it's such a well-rendered ape that you just can't help but wonder, seriously, where is the genitalia?
It had to be there somewhere. It had to be there somewhere.
Seriously. I mean,
everything else, you could see millions of lines in the palm of his hand. It was like the most incredibly detailed Kong palm ever put on film. But where's the junk?
Yeah, where's the junk? Where is the Kong dong, such as it were? So Peter Jackson
would have put a dong on this.
Oh, one. Yeah. I have no doubt that Peter Jackson actually had a fully rendered Kong dong that the studio said, we are erasing all of those from all of us. They probably didn't even tell him. So generally speaking, like, I found this, while there are some fun moments, I really enjoy John C. Reilly. He kind of gives the movie the little bit of its loopy insanity that I think it really needs. Ultimately, this felt like Grierson and I talk about with a lot of these movies. It felt less like a movie than we are getting our franchise back on track so we could get this moving in the future. Am I being too cynical about this?
I think you're not being too cynical. I agree with pretty much every word you said. My name is Tim Grierson, and I'm just trying to keep this as close to normal as possible. No shots, Tim.
Yes.
No, I just happen to agree on this one. It was like one of those movies where you sit in it and then you leave it and you might never think about it again unless you were going on to a podcast to talk about it. It's a movie that happens to you for 2 hours. You don't feel a lot of things during the movie and then it's over. And then sometimes if you're like me, you sit there and you're the last person in the theater waiting for the post-credit scene, and then you see the post-credit scene and you kind of shrug and go, oh, all right, there's going to be more of these, and you walk out.
Yes, and it's funny because what I found myself concentrating on, which I tend to in movies like this that are so obviously, these are big tentpole movies moving for other things, is to see, okay, which actors are getting something out of this, which actors are embarrassing themselves, which actors are just kind of going through their paces. And I found myself thinking that a lot, particularly with Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson, who, you know, Tom Hiddleston clearly trying to play this like muscular, like British Indiana Jones type character too.
Yeah, he's the swashbuckler, but no swashes are buckled by Tom Hiddleston right. In this movie at all.
No, he just kind of is there.
He's kind of there. It's supposed to be his movie, and he's just kind of there.
Yeah, I will say I don't think that this is not going to be like the Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow where you're like, oh, wow, this person could be an awesome action hero. Let's totally make this person. I do not think Tom Hiddleston has that in his future in this
movie. This is not that.
No.
If this was supposed to be that, it failed at being that. There are like 15 characters in this movie and there's only one character that matters at all, and that's the John C. Reilly's character.
Yeah, and I want to get to him in a second because to me, like, there's obviously I like all of these actors. Brie Larson is, it's funny because
Brie,
She's so great, and she's so, like, her as an actress, in general, she's so open. Yeah, yeah. And she's so open, and she's so, like her, like, she just is an actress that reeks of empathy. And here she takes some pictures of villagers, and I don't know about you, my audience, which I think was generally on the side of this movie, did actively groan when she referred to herself as an anti-war photographer.
my audience had no reaction to anything in the movie.
Yes. That's, again, another point for Kong Dong, if that could have actually happened in this. It's funny, David Edelstein in New York Magazine mentioned something that I've actually been thinking for a while in his review of this, which referred specifically to Samuel L. Jackson, who, like, I remember when Samuel L. Jackson was in, like, The Red Violin, and, like when he after he became the big star with Pulp Fiction, he would, like, take these interesting little movies and do, like, interesting little parts in them, and he has basically, I think he's given an okay performance. He was okay in Django Unchained, a movie I wasn't crazy about, but he was good. I thought he was good in that. He's had a couple of moments, but honestly, he has now just been Samuel L. Jackson for 20 years, and particularly it's a problem here, because there's literally a moment where, A, he gets to say motherfucker, two, he gets to say bitch please, and it's like, okay, like, to me, that shows how kind of little's going on in this movie, that there's a little moment they're just like, okay, Samuel L. Jackson, just do your Snakes on a Plane thing for a second, just to keep people interested.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the cash register ringing in the background. You know, it's just another Samuel L. Jackson. Sure, I'll be in that. You know, I have a 2 months free in right. in mid-August to shoot this. His character is, like, slightly more developed than the other characters that have no development whatsoever, like Brie Larson's character, like Tom Hiddleston's character. You know, at least Samuel L. Jackson gets to play the suddenly Colonel Kirched out obsessive military guy who is behind every bad decision made in the movie. Every decision where you're like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Everyone's telling you not to go do that. Don't go do that. And then he goes and does it.
Yes, the police commissioner in Die Hard role will live on forever. The guy that makes every wrong decision so the plot may continue to roll along. What did you think of the actions? The action sequences. It's funny. Like, again, I keep getting caught up on Peter Jackson, but his are so kind of thrilling and so kind of nuts and so kind of well thought through. These. It's funny, I don't know what you felt about Jurassic World. I thought Grierson and I are both on the same page that we think Jurassic World is pretty terrible, and. For the character stuff in that is actually even worse than it is in this. But also, I feel like even the...
There's no running in heels in this, at least.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And no Chris Pratt on a motorcycle, like, yeah. Saying, shh, girl, to both
Chris
a girl
Pratt
and
just,
a...
Just yes. Kind of like tapping a wrench near a motorcycle. Like, he might fix it, but he might just tap the wrench on it for a while to show that he's the kind of guy who gets his hands dirty.
Yes, and occasionally looking at supporting characters and going, easy... Easy. Yeah.
But see, this movie will produce zero memes, and at least Jurassic World gave us that meme.
Yes, it did. And, but I think that's one of the things that I think the action sequence in that movie aren't even that exciting either. And here, they feel perfunctory, but more to the point, they feel like, look, we've got this CGI King Kong, who, looks real, and these and all of these crazy animals. Some of the animals are like animals on the island are kind of interesting. I like the insect that has legs like massive trees, and you don't realize that.
You mean the spider? It's a giant spider. It's just a giant spider.
Right. It is, but they look like the trees around them, and it's kind of interesting.
It's true. It had bamboo legs. It was a giant spider with bamboo legs. How many giant spiders have we seen in movies, including in other Peter Jackson movies? You know. So I'm not that impressed by the giant spider. I'm sorry.
Okay, fair enough. I will not. I'm not gonna.
At least we weren't expecting a spider dong.
Right.
No yet. Disappointment there.
Yeah, but seriously, the abdomen was amateurly rendered.
That's true.
But I don't even think like any of the fights. It's Kong himself is kind of dull. Like not that Kong is. You know, it's funny. Like I wrote in my New Republic review that. King Kong at certain times has been like blatantly racist at certain times, but also like as the years have come along, he is always kind of whatever the current moment needs him to be and whatever the cultural moment of whatever King Kong is at that second, they kind of like will build whatever theme around him there is. And here there's actually no thematic moment.
There's
actually
no thing. Theme to it. No kind of philosophical underpinning, good or bad. He's, I mean, he's, you know, there's this general thing that they're building up and is not developed very well about just the being the enemy that is conjured, you know, when we need an enemy. But that's about it. It doesn't really go too deep into that. That's just part of like Samuel L. Jackson's motivation, you know, as a warmonger who's going to miss the shit, you know?
Yeah.
Right. He wants to jump right back in the shit. That's how this movie starts. It's like the phone rings. Hey, Samuel L., would you like to go back to the shit since you were about to take a helicopter away from the shit? And he says, put me back in the shit. And then he goes and he produces the shit where there might not have been the shit.
And the grunts are like, guess we're going back in the shit.
Sure, we could go home from Vietnam, but why not? Let's go to this mysterious island.
It's funny because I wonder if this is because Grace and I just did The Deer Hunter on Reboot, but I definitely found something very facile about the way they kind of use Vietnam in this movie. Like, it's basically Vietnam is, okay, so I can conjure up good Vietnam movies in my imagery and play a bunch of CCR songs on the soundtrack.
Yeah, this soundtrack was like, I think they just put into Spotify 70s war movie soundtrack and everything that popped up went in. I mean, it was just like, when are we going to get the Fogerty? When are we going to get the CCR? When are we going to hear Run Through the Jungle? and then you hear it. It's like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, it's very Robert Zemeckis that way. It's very like very obvious moment of that obvious music moment from like a 15 song one CD. Now that's what I call Vietnam soundtrack. Okay, I feel like we should close with John C. Reilly, who I do think is the one kind of spark of life in this movie, to the point where he's such a spark of life that the movie, which I think generally considers him not a minor character, but certainly not one of the major characters, decides once it's over, not to spoiler alert there, once it's over, to hark back and give him this feel-good moment, which really feels like they showed the movie and everyone was like, there's only one person in this movie I care about at all. That's John C. Reilly. Give him another scene. Yeah. And then
obviously,
they gave him another scene.
He was the one thing that tested well. They were like, we gotta wrap up his story somehow. I guess we can throw all the spoiler alerts on this section if we want to talk about how that played out. But I mean, he wasn't a character in the movie until about halfway through, maybe. And then he's the only thing worth watching after that. And so then, you know, he very obviously foreshadows his ultimate fate. And then we get to actually see it.
So. I will give the movie one point of credit on this. It doesn't do the wedding singer thing, which is Grace and I have mentioned this before in the podcast. One of our pet peeves is the wedding singer thing where he yells at Adam Sandler, yells at his ex-girlfriend, who says, take off that Van Halen. He says, take off that Van Halen t-shirt before you curse the band and break up, which is one of my least favorite things that movies do. I will give the movie credit for not saying, you're a fan of the Cubs, they're never gonna win the World Series. I will give
them. They sort of did that though. There was a scene where they kind of were talking about how bad they were, weren't they? When they're talking to him about what's happened in baseball since 1943.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, they could have had that conversation in 2001 or 2011. That's really true. any other time.
If you want to talk about very on the nose foreshadowing lines, do you remember what the first line of the movie was?
No, I don't.
It was something like, well, at least our politics couldn't possibly be more screwed up than this.
Oh, right. I do remember that.
That's like the first spoken word in the movie.
Topical.
Yeah. Very topical.
Good job.
Let's give it a point for that.
Okay, so I'm not going to make you do a letter grade. You had to suffer through our letter grades for so many years when we were doing them at Yahoo. So
I'll give it a letter grade.
Okay, okay, good, good. All right. Win in Rome. What's your letter grade?
C-.
I'm a C+. I'm a little bit more. I feel like it's rendered competently enough that I was never angry at it. But C- would require more ire from me. I don't have a ton of.
All right. Ire. Well, maybe my scale is a little less forgiving, because I won't say I was angry at it, but I was just, like I said, I was fairly bored by it and walked out of it thinking I would never think of it again. You know, and like when I actually like that less than a movie that's a disaster, because at least I'll think about a disaster again and I'll have fun talking about it. But this is just not that fun. You know, it happened. It's a movie that happens to you and then it's over and then you go about your life.
Yeah, it's weird because I guess the next thing they're going to do, also one thing that I am terrible at to this day is I just staying through the credits. Like I so rarely do it. I usually have to have Grierson tell me what it is. But from what I understand, there is they're setting up like a Godzilla thing. There's going to be a King Kong Godzilla.
Yes, there's a shared universe, an expanded universe that is all those classic giant monsters. Mothra, there's going to be a Mothra thing. Eventually they're building to a Kong versus Godzilla movie, but I don't think it's the next step. I think it's like two or three steps away.
All right. Well, I'm sure, I mean, audiences will be clamoring to see Tom Hiddleston get back at it. That's kind of the funny thing about like the Jurassic World sequel. It's like, oh, great. We get to see her some more. She was so interesting the first time.
He can't even be in the next ones because he's in his 30s maybe in the movie, in this movie in the 70s. And then it has to catch up to Godzilla, which took place in the present day, right? So that would age him up about 40 years. So he'd be too old. He'd have to be under the age makeup or... you know, they'll have to recast him. So he is one and done, I think.
So that is Kong Skull Island. Let's go to our second and final movie here with the esteemed Mr. Lasanti. Our second movie is Personal Shopper.
What are you doing in Paris?
I'll take it.
This too.
It's 500 for the belt and 2,000 for each bag.
Great. I'm a personal shopper. Kira's very high profile.
Hey, Kira.
She can't do normal things, so I assist her.
You have nothing better to do besides dress Kira?
I'm waiting.
What are you waiting for?
Personal Shopper is written and directed by Olivier Assayas. It was a big hit at the Cannes Film Festival last year. Assayas won the Best Director Award. Shared it with Christian Mungiu. Chris is not here to say the names for me for Graduation. So it stars Kristen Stewart. She is a personal shopper for a wealthy woman, a very successful woman. She basically takes care of all of her... She jet sets the world, takes all of her, tries on the clothing, picks out what she needs. And in addition, is also apparently a medium, or was a medium, along with her twin brother. Her twin brother has recently died, and she is attempting to conjure up her twin brother while also perhaps being menaced by some sort of man who is texting her we'll get into this in a moment, in some of the, I can't tell if it is among the best, worst, or both extended texting scenes in a dramatic movie. We'll get into that in a moment. But basically, the movie is kind of a psychological thriller. It goes on into the mind of Kristen Stewart's Marine character. The movie, like some of Assayas's other stuff, is partly a thriller. You think it's a thriller, and then it becomes a weird, like, look into the supernatural. Then it becomes this look inside her head. Then it becomes this kind of art parody. And it kind of, every time you think this movie, you know where this movie is going, it takes a little bit, it takes certainly a very sharp turn on you. There are times I found that actually very thrilling. I liked being kept off of my feet in a lot of ways. And there are also times where I found it a little distancing to, every time I felt I was getting involved in something, the movie was pulling the rug out from under me, but not to any major usage, just to move on to another kind of weird, quirky movie. I like the sensibility of this movie. I like its unconventionality. I love her in this movie. We should probably talk about her after we get going. But first off, Grierson loves this movie. He gave it an A-. He was a big, big fan of this movie. I don't love it quite as much, but I certainly found it mostly pretty impossible to look away from.
Yeah, I liked it a lot too. Maybe not A-. I guess we'll save the letter grades for later. But for all the reasons you said, I mean, it was really interesting mix of genre, you know, supernatural thriller, psychological thriller, kind of murder mystery, you know, I guess ghost story also fits under supernatural thriller. You know, I thought it was great. Kristen Stewart is pretty amazing. And if not for some bad timing of release, maybe, you know, up for Oscars. It's a little early to talk about that stuff now, but you never know. You know, this performance might stick around. She's pretty incredible. She's great in just about everything, but this is, you know, she's almost this whole movie. She's about 80% of what's on screen in this movie, and she's riveting and sort of also impenetrable, you know, about as impenetrable as like the movie's ultimate intentions probably are. But that's a great, you know, match of sensibility and actress there. She's great.
Yeah, and the movie is frustrating in the way that she's frustrating, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I found that among the best things about the movie. I like that it kind of frustrated your expectations constantly. You know, maybe it didn't give you the resolution that some people would like, but you know, the ambiguity of the whole thing was really intriguing and really well done, I thought.
Yeah, and, you know, and even, it's funny because there are times in this movie where it feels like an actual, like the ghost story stuff really works like pretty well. It's actually pretty scary.
Yeah, like, it plays like a horror movie, especially in that one section where, I mean, if we're going to get a little bit, how spoilery are we going to get?
This is a difficult movie to spoil because it's difficult to grab too much of a finger on what's actually happening.
It's true. But the scene where you actually first see the apparition, it plays like a horror movie. I mean, it was like a Guillermo del Toro kind of thing. Light because it's not going so hard into like really amazing renderings of effects, but you know, it has that kind of, had that almost like Crimson Peak vibe in that scene without all the, like the beautiful decay of a del Toro, you know, tableau, but it had that feel to it.
Yeah. And I think that like, so that stuff works really well. And I think that she is, because the movie is also, as much as it's a horror movie, it takes this turn into like a murder mystery. But it's also, if there's one thing that I find myself grabbing onto most in the movie, the thing I think most about, is it's grief. Like, really, it's kind of her grief over the loss of her brother and her inability to not only express it, but even be able to kind of grapple with it herself, particularly in this situation. Like, she's unable to really connect with anyone. She has this boyfriend who she seems to talk with only over Skype, and then till he actually meets her, and then there's nothing. And then they seem like they just met each other as opposed to have been together for a long time. She's really kind of, the thing that I think works best about the movie is she's kind of floating through the world the way that I think grief will do to you. It will make you very disconnected from what's going on, but also occasionally deeply terrified. And that, you know, and I guess that this is a good time to get into the text messages. There's a very kind of fascinating and weirdly riveting, I'll say, whatever your thoughts about Esaias, he definitely can make like, there's like a 15-minute text message back and forth that goes on in the middle of this movie. It changes locations. But generally, like, there are these increasingly menacing text messages that I have to say I would have never thought they'd be able to be made as dramatic as they are here. But they are. It's actually, like, it becomes scary and mysterious and also kind of curious and mysterious and intriguing in a way that I don't know if I would trust a lot of other filmmakers to try to pull that off. But I certainly like the way that he did it.
Yeah, it was almost like a chase scene via text message. It's, you know, it's probably the tensest part of the movie, and it's pretty incredible the way that he pulled it off. I mean, and it, you know, that thread of the text message extends for a while and then ultimately resolves with the, you know, the if we're going to get spoilery about I'm outside the building, I'm on the landing. You know, it's like your heart's kind of in your throat at that point, and you're just reading an iPhone screen. So that's a pretty masterful thing to be able to ratchet up tension like that just looking at a phone screen, you know?
Yeah, and I think that might be what leaves
much more effective than the movie Nerve.
But yes.
Which also has like a kind of chase scene by social media vibe to it.
Yes. Yeah, no offense. No offense,
Nerve.
Yes, no offense, Shulman's, but what's funny about it, though, I think what I find intriguing, but again, ultimately distancing, is that notion that even that scene, you don't quite get the payoff that you have grown to expect, which is something that I find myself admiring more about the movie than I find myself getting excited about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You can admire it and also simultaneously be frustrated by it, but the frustration, you know, you also have to realize was probably at least some of his intent. You don't get all your answers at the end, but you get something that feels like it's close to the answer. You know, it's definitely open for interpretation in a lot of things. Really, the only, you get a little bit of resolution on the murder mystery part of it, if you want to believe, you know, that one scene where with the shootout, if you want to believe that all happened as it's being represented. But it doesn't really give you the ultimate answers about whether she's really contacted her brother or whether this is a manifestation of her grief, like you were saying. There's a lot of ways that you could interpret it and probably be correct.
Yeah, and I think a main thing, I want to kind of close with this, is Kristen Stewart. She is, you're right in that she's very kind of impenetrable, but there is something there's still something, it's not so much that she's off. Like, it's funny because, like, I think of some actresses who I think are really good, but when they're impenetrable, it's almost like with this alien sense. I feel like Scarlett Johansson is a good example of that. Like, an actress that I think is pretty good, but seems to be like almost a being from another planet sometimes. She, Kristen Stewart, is very, like, very much a real person here. I think, like, one of the things I love about her, she's got this quality of being remote and distant in a way that you're never going to be able to put your finger on, but also weirdly relatable in a way that feels, she feels like an actual person. I think that this is a movie that uses that and does that really, really well.
Yeah. When I said impenetrable, I don't mean inhuman. I mean, I think in a very human way, you know, like, you just, she's just a little hard to read, and she's obviously going through, you know, a very hard emotional time and losing her brother and dealing with the grief around that, and also apparently, like, what she's going to do with her life. She's adrift, you know, she has this job that doesn't fulfill her. There's some talk of what could she go do that would fulfill her more, but it, you know, that never really gets explored too much. You know, most of the thrust of this movie is her just dealing with the grief of this one thing and looking for that sign from her brother about whether or not there is an afterlife to look forward to or not, which is pretty fascinating.
All right, so what did you end up giving it?
I give it a B+.
Yeah. Hey, we are B plus brothers on this one. I agree. I also give it a B+. Grish is a little higher on it than I am, but I think it's definitely very compelling. And I feel like, you know, one of the things, it's funny, you know, Vulture always does these, let's talk about the ending of that. Kevin Lincoln does a good job on them. And, but it's funny, this is like the least satisfying let's talk about the ending of, because it's really just like, I don't want answers on this. Like, I don't want this to be resolved. I don't want this to have a big wrap up thing. Even if there's a theory, we all have our own theories about it, but I feel like this is not a movie that lends itself to, like, fan theories. It's better the less you know and the less you kind of think about.
Yeah, I don't think that there is a correct answer about what the ending means. You know, I think it's 100% up to the individual viewer's interpretation. There's things that happen, you know, and to the extent that you see this, you know, physical manifestation of a spirit and the communication from the spirit, you know, that exists, it seems to exist, but what it means ultimately is going to be up to, you know, how you feel about it yourself.
All right, so that is Personal Shopper. Olivia says it's still, it's playing in Los Angeles, New York right now, but I think it will be spreading wide here pretty soon for the rest of you minions to have a chance to see it. So, Mark, thank you for filling in with me. I hope you had fun. I didn't want to take up too much of your time. So thanks for coming and playing around in our little sandbox and doing a much better impersonation of Grierson than Grierson does himself.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for having me. I look forward to hearing Tim back on the microphone soon with his brand new vocal cords.
Yeah.
All up free vocal cords. I guess I should check his Facebook page to see if he's posted the polyp photography that he bragged about last week. It sounds disgusting, and maybe I want to see that.
Yes. I'm a little disappointed, though, because I wanted, like, some drugged-up Grierson. Grierson is a very sober-minded person. I would have loved just, like, Grierson unleash on social media under the influence of post-surgery drugs. Unfortunately, as I probably should have suspected, that was not the Grierson we're going
to get. Let's talk him into 24 hours of posting his polyp pictures every hour.
Boy, Grierson
has a big comeback to social media.
Yeah, Grierson comes back and has zero Facebook followers and zero Twitter followers. And I think he actually may even be happy that way. All right, Mark, so where can we find it? Where can we find you for all the people that are now like, wow, I'm itching for more Mark Lasanti. Where can we find you and follow all the good things that you provide to this great world of ours?
I guess go to Twitter first, just at Mark Lasanti. You know, check Will's Twitter account. He'll retweet it if you can't spell my name. I'm at MTV News, but I'm mostly editing there. So, you know, I did edit up until recently Amy Nicholson, who's a brilliant movie critic among our finest.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So you should read her movie opinions on there instead of caring about what I say on Twitter. I'll give this a plug for Amy instead of for me.
There's no reason we cannot do both of these things because Amy is brilliant. She is terrific, it's funny. I always want to do a podcast with Grace about this, about the critics that after I've seen a movie and after I've written my own review, the ones I absolutely make sure to go back and read. There's like 10. There's like 10, maybe 10, 15 critics. So no matter what, I want to know what they thought of the movie. And Amy is absolutely one of them.
That's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You should have said, there are like two and Amy is one of them.
No, 10, that's, there are,
that's a lot of critics to read.
There are so many critics. There are, I may care about this shit too much, but there are so many critics. To believe you me, that is quite a culling. That is quite a culling of people.
That's true.
To get from 10 to 15.
Now name all the rest of them so that everyone who's not on the list can feel bad.
If you think that you are on this list, listener, you are.
Yeah, that's a good way to play it.
Yes. All right, Mark, thank you for coming on. I've had a blast. And if Grierson ends up beaten down and unable to come back anytime soon, I'll see if we can have you back on.
Oh, that'd be great. But Tim's gonna come back 1,000%.
1,000%
better.
1,000% beautiful.
No polyp. He's gonna be great. None of that extra gravel. His voice will be golden once again.
Yes, he's more machine than polyp now. All right, thanks, Mark.
All right, thanks, Will. Bye.
All right, that leads us to a reboot movie. This week's reboot is A Fish Called Wanda.
How about Russians? Your silo blagodat ne sozvushi slov zhivu. Vmina to zhezhni prudnuyu, tesnitsa le vesyantsa grosti. Adno malitvu chudnuyu, tverzhuya naizusti. Dushi kak bremya skatitsa sunyenya. Далеко. И верится, и плачется, и так легко.
Archie.
Yeah?
Are you rich?
No, I'm afraid not.
What about the house?
Well, that's Wendy. She's the rich one.
Oh.
Fish Called Wanda came out in 1988. It is directed by Charles Crichton. And apparently co-directed, if an uncredited way, by John Cleese. Of course, written by John Cleese and starring John Cleese. Kevin Kline, Jamie Lee Curtis, Michael Palin. Kevin Kline won an Oscar for his role in this movie, playing Otto, the ugly American. St. Louis's own Kevin Kline. Bless his heart. The story, of course, is about a barrister named played by John Cleese, who ends up coming across a con artist, Wanda Gershowitz, and her boyfriend / lunkhead American, Otto, played by Kevin Kline. They are trying to get these diamonds, and they come across John Cleese, and she has to try to seduce him. And there's Michael Palin, who is a stuttering assassin, part of their kind of heist. It's kind of a heist movie. It's also, of course, mostly a comedy. One of the reasons that people, I think, have been excited, because we've hated so many 80s movies on this podcast, particularly 80s comedies. I think people were trying to, I know there was a spate of people giving us reviews of movies saying, okay, they'll have to like this one. They'll have to like this one. And I think inevitably, A Fish Called Wanda came up from that. I had seen Fish Called Wanda and liked it very much when I first saw it. Watching it again, you know, there's a few moments. First off, oh, God, why does every 80s comedy have a blackface scene? Seriously, why does every 80s comedy have a blackface scene? And they're all Rasta guys. Like, stop. I've now seen both Dan Aykroyd and Michael Palin as in blackface and Rasta. Like, stop. Stop, please. Just, I mean, they did stop, fortunately. But nevertheless, I guess living, I was 13 years old when this movie came out. And this did not give me the run screaming out of the room blackface that Dan Aykroyd did.
This one is mildly defensible. Mildly. In fact, so much so I was actually not convinced I had seen what I thought I had seen in this movie. But yeah, go ahead.
So there's a lot really funny about this movie. And we'll get into some of the things that work and some of the things that don't. But to me, I don't know if you can agree with me on this. The thing that really knocked people out about this movie, and I said he won an Oscar for it when he did, was Kevin Kline. And I'm sorry, he is still the funniest goddamn thing in this movie. Some of the jokes are a little obvious. He definitely is very cartoonish. He's more cartoonish than I think the movie necessarily needs at times. I think the movie generally, as much as it is a comedy and it sometimes goes over the top, it's dry in a way that he is not. He definitely plays it up. He's definitely over the top. But God damn it, did I laugh every single time that Kevin Kline did anything in this movie, whether it's pork away, pal, or it's coming to kill me. It's just the funniest thing in the entire world. And I know stuttering jokes, not age well. A lot of the stuttering stuff is not aged well, but god damn it. Ooh, you English are so superior. Or the fact that every single time that he gets instructions, he gets lost. Is that what was the one in the middle?
Yeah, that's a joke I had forgotten, I have to say. Because some of them I remembered very well. Like, we didn't lose, it was a tie. I remember
it was
that.
A tie. I think we sure had real good.
It's like, I remember that. I forgot though. What was the one in the middle? I had forgotten that running joke.
And yeah. There's a great thing when that joke is established, where the British guy that Wanda is, the original guy that they're scheming before they end up trying to scheme other people, the original guy that they're scheming, he is explaining the plan, and there's this great shot of Kevin Kline just looking so gloriously dumbly into the middle distance, and then he finishes the plan. They're like, so you got that? And that's the first time we get the, wait, what was the part in the middle again? Like, Kevin Kline has the most amazing dumb guy face in this movie. Again, he's sometimes a little bit too bug-eyed for the movie, but he's such, like, he just kills me. Kevin Kline is, like, not really in a lot of things anymore. I think he's in the next Beauty and the Beast movie coming up, and I think he's, like, I've loved him in a lot of stuff. I always thought he was great in In and Out. Like, he's, and you know, he's great in serious roles, too. But man, oh man, there is not. Well, we can discuss the movie in general, but I cannot get over Kevin Kline absolutely fucking kills me in this movie.
Yeah, I don't like him quite as much. I'm not sure if any human being could like him as much as you just did. He's pretty like bug-eyed.
Park away, pal.
He's definitely funny in it. I actually have some. I think I actually like better in the movie, though. I have to be honest. As much as I like him, Jamie Lee Curtis, I think, is actually,
she's awesome.
She's actually, I think, really, really tremendous. And you know, and she wasn't nominated even for like either the BAFTAs. I think it was the BAFTAs where like everybody got nominated except for her. She's. Like between this, and we talked about Trading Places, of course, on the podcast. Like, she did like that sexy, funny thing really, really great. The reason why I may like her, the fact that I do like her better than Kevin Kline, even in this movie, is that where he's dumb and that's really funny, she's actually like really smart and really conniving. And this thing about that character, I will always probably like a little more because you don't know exactly what she's doing, but you know she's thinking. And there's something really fun and appealing about that character. Yes, I also wondered if we were getting these this as a suggestion, because people are like, please God, just tell us you like this 80s comedy at least. And this one I think is a lot. This one is actually held up pretty well. You know, some of the gay panic humor is not so great. It's just sort of okay. The stuttering thing actually doesn't bother me so much, because I actually think Michael Palin does it in such a vulnerable way that it actually, like, you actually feel bad for that character, and so you feel the suffering that he's going through. And his revenge on Kevin Kline is so great at the end of the movie. It's sort of wonderful. My understanding is that, you know, Charles Crayton, who'd done all these, you know, Ealing comedies back in the day, he was an older gentleman at this time. And so essentially John Cleese was kind of like the way Paul Thomas Anderson was on Prairie Home Companion with Robert Altman, where he was like the backup as insurance so that the movie could get financed and get made. So like Crane, you know, directed it, but John Cleese was sort of by his side just to be on the safe side. I had forgotten this movie got three nominations. I had forgotten that Crichton actually got nominated for Best Director for this, which is kind of mind blowing. I mean, this movie was a big hit. I was actually looking, it was number 12 for the year. Like, it almost made as much money as Working Girl. It made more money than Scrooge. Like, this was a huge, 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 huge summer comedy smash. I think for me, what I am reminded when I saw this movie again is that it's just like the plot is kind of indecipherable, and I found myself just not caring after a while. I just enjoyed people being mean and jerks to each other so much in this movie, and watching kind of, again, like, I just love Jamie Lee Curtis's character Wanda, how she just sort of threads the needle through this movie, and I would also argue legitimately makes you feel like that she has real feelings for John Cleese's character named Archie. Like, I think you actually do get a sense that they do have a connection, as opposed to the other people that she's kind of like taking for a ride in this movie. You buy that she actually kind of falls for just how genuinely, earnestly sweet and kind of naive that he is. She falls for him. And I buy that in the movie.
If anyone goes through a change, it's her. Like, basically he's like constricted by his, you know, very, very serious British life. And he loosens up when he meets her and becomes his true self. But really, she's the one. It's funny because one thing I did not remember having seen a long time ago was how quickly you realize that she's using Otto too. Like, I remembered her being farther along in their relationship. But remember, when they go to get to open up the safe, she's about ready to whack him too and be done with him too. Like, I didn't realize how much, from the very beginning of the movie, she's using Otto. She's really using everyone. And I think that it, like trading places, it's another movie where she's the smartest person in the movie. And you recognize it immediately. And it's just funny. I just didn't realize how great, just what a great run this was for her and how good she is. To me, Otto is just still, like, I like it when he tries to wake up the fish. That's another great part. He tries to wake up the fish. Or when he talks about how, oh no, the monks used to do this to psych themselves up before battle. She's like, I don't think that you are. What kind of Buddhism are you talking about? There's just the fact that he reads philosophy. Apes can read philosophy too. They just don't understand it.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, that may be my favorite line in the whole movie. Yes, monkeys can do it. Yeah, it's you know, we play this game sometimes with the reboot, which is, could this be released through a studio now? You know, whoever the comparable stars of our time are now, maybe this could still be like a studio movie. But it's like this idea. I'm trying to think like back to like 1988, what was going on. It's like, okay, we'll take two people from Monty Python. We'll take two people from the U.S. and sort of like combine them together. Is that a guarantee for a box office hit? I don't know. Is that?
I mean, what is this now? Is this like Simon Pegg and Seth Rogen? Is that what this is now?
Probably.
Yeah. Simon Pegg, Seth Rogen, and
like James Franco would play the dumb guy. Maybe, I will say, as a big Bob's Burgers fan, it's now hard for me to hear Kevin Kline's voice and not think of Mr. Fish Owner. I just sort of hear that character now every time that that he talks. I mean, it's also kind of funny because it is kind of a combination of like this sort of like wry, upper crust British dry sort of comedy where you have farce and stuff like that. And then you just have like people being stupid. Like, obviously the Kevin Kline character is just really, really dumb. So just so I'm clear, he's never been in the CIA, right? Like, that's never happened.
I assume no.
Yeah.
He would be dead.
Right? Because there's always a part of me, I was like, wait, so... Like, is it, because it could go either way, where it's like, right. No, he actually was, he was just that stupid, or he's just making that up. Yeah. I was never...
This is also another entry in the Will and Tim learn about past tendencies of airline security.
This is the great subsection of the reboot. It's like, wow, air travel... What was that about?
Yeah, apparently you could get on a plane with a gun if you simply, right before you walk through the metal detector, flip the gun in the air outside the metal detector and then catch it on the other side.
Yeah.
That way, that works. That's the way it works. You can do that.
don't try that now. Also, and of course I remember this time, but I do love where it's like, we're through airport security. Here, take my pass, like take my boarding pass. Like that, there was a time where you could just do that. Yes. Like, that's actually like a real legitimate thing that human beings used to be able to do on planes. Yeah, it's as far as things that don't necessarily work, I do think some of the humor is a little creaky. There's a little too much of some of the farce elements. I don't think entirely work. That could be my own kind of aversion to farce in general, that a little of that goes a long way for me. But, you know, I laugh pretty consistently. I laughed at the end titles that explain what happened to everybody. Mm. I thought that was very, very amusing. Yeah, this is, this holds up pretty nicely.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Oh, man. I just, every time I think of Otto, he makes me laugh. I'm sorry.
What's the, it's the mustache too, right? Like,
yeah, it's the mouse. You're the Bulgarian, you fuck. I'm sorry. I just, one last time, just let me do it. Not this. I'm just thinking of the Porker Way Pal, Fucker Blue. That's another good one. But, oh my God. It's Kikin coming to kill me. Oh my God, Kevin.
He's so dumb.
He's the funniest person in this movie.
He's so dumb. He didn't realize he put his feet into that that cement.
It's Humble Limey week.
Well, this goes back to the whole thing. Like back when Kevin Kline would actually be in movies, like when he was clean shaven, he was a serious actor. Mm-hmm. Like when he has a mustache, he's goofy and dumb. And so like this falls brilliantly into that category of. I will say, though, I know that you clearly like this performance more than I do. It is still a shock that this won the Oscar, I have to say. Because it really, like, comedy roles are, you just so rarely see that. It just so rarely happens. It's sort of this, like, amazing surprise when you go back and watch.
Not everybody can pull off, I'm Harvey Manfred Jensen.
Yes. Oh, yes.
See, yeah, I'm making you love the performance. Even
No, that's why. No,
I can just quote these all night.
Yes, to be clear on the Grierson scale of what's funny and what's not, farce, people coming up with dumb names at the spur of the moment, I always, because I mean, that's like a, like whether it's like Angie Tribeca or like Steve Martin comedies of the 80s, if you come up with a dumb name as your like alibi or your like pseudonym on the spur of the moment, I will always. And here's the thing. It's funny that Kevin Kline does that. What's funnier is that John Cleese's wife says the name perfectly in response. That's what's funny about that scene. That's what's very funny about that.
Going to shoot me? Yep. Freak soul jump. Sorry. Everything Kevin Kline does in this movie is the funniest thing in the world. So that's my viewpoint on Fish Called Wanda.
Now, I just want to
keep quoting Otto lines throughout.
Really,
this.
Really fast before I let you continue. Yes. Did you ever see the pseudo sequel?
I remember watching it then, being excited about it and being underwhelmed by it, and now I remember nothing about it.
Yes, I have never seen it because by the time it had come out, I had heard it kind of sucked, and so I never saw it. Because it's not even like the same characters, right? Like it's a totally different, it's the same actors, but like,
yes.
like different characters. Even though there's like some allusion to the first film in some way, but yes. I want to preserve the memory of A Fish Called Wanda and just let it be its own thing. Also, I am on record, killing animals by mistake is funny.
It is funny.
I know. Some people don't like that. I think that's very funny in this movie. So yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the recommendation of A Fish Called Wanda. I encourage any listeners to give us A Fish Called Wanda as a reboot again. And I will just quote Otto lines that the entire episode, because God damn, he makes me laugh. All right. So that is A Fish Called Wanda, our reboot section. Thank you for that idea. That was obviously a lot of fun. All right. We will say goodbye to Grierson. There. Bye, Grierson. Back to Polyp Land. That's, of course, something that we pre-recorded. So bye, Grierson. You'll be back next week with a couple other reboots, which we'll get to in a moment. First off, thanks again to Mark Lasanti for coming on. That was very enjoyable. He is one of my favorite people in the world and definitely one of the funniest people I know. And one of the few people I would feel comfortable discussing this much Kong penis with. So we have a new special guest next week. I'm very excited to have Christy Lemire. Christy Lemire from the AP, formerly of the old At the Movies Roger Ebert Show, one of my favorite people in the world and one of the best film critics working. We are delighted to have her on. She'll be filling in for Grierson next week. We are hoping that that is, in fact, the last one that Grierson's going to miss. I think he's going to go back to his doctor this week. I think they're hoping that this will be the last one. He'll be able to come back and do the show. So we've budgeted for only two shows for him to miss. If he misses another one, I don't know what's going to happen. But Christy and I are going to discuss two movies, one of which I will have not seen, so I'm just going to interview her about it. We're going to first be discussing Beauty and the Beast. I'll be reviewing that for The New Republic this week, Beauty and the Beast, the remake, except with people, not pictures, of the 1991 Disney classic starring Emma Watson, Dan Stevens, Ewan McGregor. Ewan. That's my Ewan McGregor First Nation. This is what happens when I don't have Grierson around to tell me to stop doing things. He is in that movie. Speaking of Ewan McGregor, he's also in our second movie, which is T2 Trainspotting. The Trainspotting sequel will be out. Unfortunately, I will not be having that screened for me here in the Georgia area before we get a chance to do that podcast next week. So I'll just be asking Christy a bunch of questions about it. I also may ask her about the Belko Experiment, which is the movie opening next week. We also have two reboots next week. Now, of course, as mentioned, Grierson and I have already discussed both of these reboot movies, so they're in the can. I already know what he thinks about them. The first movie is from 1969, Easy Rider. Easy Rider, directed by Dennis Hopper, starring Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda in a very young, very amazing Jack Nicholson. So that is Easy Rider. Our second reboot movie next week, again, also in the can, is Repo Man. Repo Man came out in 1984, written directed by Alex Cox, starring Emilio Estevez, Harry Dean Stanton, Cy Richardson, and a floating green car. So we'll be back next week with Christy to discuss Trainspotting, two Ewan McGregor movies, Trainspotting and Beauty and the Beast, and then we'll be back with reboots for Easy Rider and Repo Man. Thank you for hanging with us this week. We're going to get Grierson back as quick as we can. One more next week with the even awesomer Christy Lemire. Have a great week, everyone. Bye.
Wicked, wicked Wanda, what was it that spawned ya? Who's responsible for your trash? A pretty little spider with Hollywood insider and no time to